It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
You'll see Carol Lombard and Robert Montgomery together for the first time. You'll see one of the funniest comedy situations that ever hit the screen. You'll see what happens when Mr. and Mrs. Smith discover that they were never legally married.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero. Excuse me, wait a minute. Put the brakes on that. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Psycho? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am joined by my usual companions who are all psychoanalysts. We have Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is great to be here.
We have Mr. Trey Hooks.
Hello, everyone.
And we have Mr. Blaine Dowler.
Hello, all.
So today, due to the extreme calculations of Mr. Dowler, we are doing a somewhat different Hitchcock movie, because this is Hitchcock's one and only screwball comedy, and realistically, it's his only comedy that isn't a black comedy. So this is definitely very, very different for different Hitchcock fare than we are used to. And as has been the case with more movies than I really expected, I've never seen this before. It probably would not have come up on my radar unless I had been just going like through the guide on TCM and seeing what's coming up and see that it's a Hitchcock movie I haven't seen and put it on for that reason alone. But that, I think, would have been the only reason why I might have caught it at any given time, but I had not until now. What I wanted to do before we go into it is I just wanted to talk about the definition of screwball comedy a little bit, because that always threw me off. As a kid, when I heard the word name screwball comedy, I kind of pictured something extremely silly, like the kind of movie Jerry Lewis would make in the 1950s. Like, that would be screwball to me, because that would be what my knee-jerk definition would be. But that is not it. And when I had a film class one of my first film class in high school, they showed us the movie Bringing Up Baby as an example of screwball comedy with Cary Grant. Screwball comedies are a subgenre of a romantic comedy, and my understanding is the distinction is that instead of having fun at the circumstances that the two leads get together, the comedy is more making fun of the whole love aspect between them, and that's what creates the screwball thought, because it's coming at it from a different angle. So this was a popular genre back in the 30s and 40s and even into the 50s. But when I've seen romantic comedies, and I was trying to think of any modern romantic comedies where they go into that type of a genre, and I am coming up empty. So if any of you have any good examples on that, let me know. But in
Does
the meanwhile,
Money Pit still count as modern? It's been about 40 years.
Which one?
The Money Pit. Mm. Tom Hanks and Shelley Long.
The only reason I would not count it as modern is because it's a remake. But I guess it's modern.
Well,
it's modern
40
in
years
my life,
so.
At least.
Yeah, that's true. I keep questioning modern because, you know, I have students that talk about, you know, this TV channel YTV in Canada, youth television, that sometimes run really, really old movies, and that's where they saw the original Ghostbusters.
Well, it's, you know, just picture like in the Marvel movies when Spider-Man says, "Oh, did you ever see that really old movie, The Empire Strikes Back?" So, I mean, yep. I guess, you know, that's, it's all perspective on age. So for me, I guess modern movies, to me, modern movies were probably from 1970s on, when the Hollywood star system kind of came to a close. I think that's where I would cut the distinction, but everybody would have their own way of doing things, I guess.
Yeah, if I were going to put a marker, it'd probably be the advent of digital editing in the mid-80s, because that, basically, computers and filmmaking in general from the 80s to the 90s was the last major milestone where I think there's a before and after.
Yeah, that's fair. And then, I mean, if you get into the, you know, you could even push that a little closer to the 90s when CGI became big. But, you know, just the same, I guess we could all put our own definitions on it. And being the oldest one in the group, I'm thinking I'm going to put the date at the earliest point. But just the same, why don't we go through everybody's first viewing of Mr. and Mrs. Smith? Sean?
Yeah, so this week, and it was actually one of those ones where, like you, I hadn't seen it before. I had mentioned it to my wife, and I said, "Listen, if you want to take a gamble on this one with me," I said, "I don't know if it's good or not." I said, "Like, I'm going to go watch it." So she actually watched it with me. And I said, "You can exit at any point in time." So I said, "This is a safe zone." I said, "I have to watch it all the way through." I said, "You can take the parachute and get off of this plane if you'd like." We watched the whole thing together this week. So that says something right there. But yeah, Mr. I didn't know this existed. That's one of the things I'm really enjoying about this study of Hitchcock. That I'm catching some films I never would have seen otherwise. So this falls in that category for me.
Okay. Trey?
this week was the first time for me as well. I think I had in my head that the Brad Pitt Angelina Jolie movie was like a remake of this. So I was expecting something completely different from what we got.
It's not unreasonable. I could see, you know, I had the same thoughts, but I don't know if I had looked it up or something else, but I knew it was not a remake by the time I watched it. How about you, Blaine?
This is my second time viewing it. My first was just, you know, after film studies, I was introduced to Hitchcock and was just trying to consume everything I could from him. So I bought the Signature Collection DVD set and just watched through. And it was a very different experience because last time I had no idea it was a comedy. So I went like Strangers on a Train and Men Who Knew Too Much. And then, right. So this, I didn't realize it was a step out of the genre. So it was a much more enjoyable experience this time because that Hitchcock name has come to be making promises that this movie did not attempt to keep. It was going a different direction. And if you have to know that.
I think that the common, and I'm going to say misconception, is that Hitchcock is like the master of horror movies. And I think that's based on Psycho and The Birds. But realistically, Hitchcock is the master of suspense, which is much more, you know, encompassing of his filmography. This comes out of that either way. It doesn't fit in that particular definition. So, yeah, if you don't know what to expect and you're just thinking Hitchcock movie, yeah, this is not what you anticipate. Now, I read a little bit, and they had said or at least I think Hitchcock said that he did this as a favor to Carol Lombard, who is the apparently queen of screwball comedies, or was the queen. She died at 33 years old, which is, you know, I had no clue. She died in a plane crash. Anyway, she was married to Clark Gable, and apparently Hitchcock and his wife and Gable and Lombard were good friends and socialized frequently. And the story was that he did this as a favor to her. However, there are indications that he pursued this as a project before that, that he wanted to do it, that I guess he wanted to stretch his boundaries a little bit, try something a little different, and did this. And while it is very well made, it didn't, and it was very well made, and it was very easy to just sit and watch it and ride along with the ride. I didn't see a lot of what I would call comedy in it. It didn't really make me laugh. There was never a point in this movie that I laughed out loud. And even then, I would say really not even chuckled much. It was just kind of comfortable watching it, and, you know, maybe you smile at a couple of things here and there. But nothing about this that was particularly comedic to me. I don't know about you guys and what you thought.
It was pretty tame for a screwball comedy. The comedy level was more what we would consider sitcom level today, I think.
Exactly. It felt like a sitcom. That was the feeling. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Trey.
No, that's fine. I was in a similar situation to you, Paul. I think, like, if I had one word to kind of describe the film, I'd call it harmless. Like, it wasn't offensive. It wasn't distasteful or bad, but it didn't. The plot twist of a married couple are not really married, which is kind of, I think, what they're wanting the antics to spring off of, just isn't as out there as, you know, you mentioned bringing up baby, you know. Paleontologist gets mixed up with socialite and her pet leopard is, you know, much more out there. Or even, you know, Carol Lombard's really known for two other films, This to Be or Not to Be and My Man Godfrey. Socialite picks up homeless man to be her butler and they fall in love. You know, that's more out there than the premise of this film.
Yeah, and the premise on this one is only out there because the original screenwriter was told by the studios, we are not doing a movie about a couple that divorces and then remarries, even though that was common because there was just so many markets in the U.S. that wouldn't show something that permanently featured divorce. So they had to restrict and cut back. So that's where it started to become absurd because, yeah, this is not something that gets terribly absurd in any stretch of the imagination, although they treat things as it, like, oh, you know how to shave him? Wow, they're treating that as absurd. And maybe it's just in the days where we're not used to having just the raw blade and we're used to the packaged razors, the electric, we don't necessarily get that. To me, it feels very rooted in 1941. So a lot of the intended humor is rooted in gender roles that are not the same 83 years later as they were then. So they, what would have been treated as more as some degree of absurdity there is just, okay, that's the way this couple works. Done.
And you needed some of that absurdity in order to, cause I think where the film worked for me, cause the sitcom actually comparison, I wasn't thinking sitcom until, you had referenced it here.
When you mentioned sitcom, one of the things that came to mind for me while I was watching this was, have they done this on any sitcoms that I watched? And the one that came to mind for me was there's an episode of I Love Lucy in the 1950s where they find or they believe that their marriage certificate is invalid and that they're not married. And then Lucy comes up with this whole scheme to have this guy come forward and say that he was her first husband. And she arranges for him to come and meet Ricky and, you know, just to make him jealous. And it turns out that the switch is that some street bum comes up and she thinks it's the guy who's going to pretend to be her first husband. And while he's talking, he's taking stuff and sticking in his pockets from their apartment. And then, you know, Ricky shakes him and all this stuff comes flying out. So it was almost like in that 22 minutes of a sitcom, they had more comedic elements than this hour and a half movie. So, again, I think Trey kind of hit it on the head for me that it's amusing, it's comfortable, but it didn't really ever make me laugh a lot. And I think, Blaine, you hit on the fact that, yeah, it's playing on tropes that no longer exist. So that's, you know, back in 1941, this may have seemed much more absurd to have a woman do things that Carol Lombard is doing in this movie.
They were also dealing with limitations. I was reading an article yesterday about this film and just the era and the fact that we're very used to now comedies going more and more extreme, you know, as far as in areas of like sex and things like that, which is not prevalent in this and couldn't be. So because they weren't protected under free speech, according to the 1915, there was a 1915 clarification that the film's not protected under that. So because of those type of codes, there's some limitations where we're very used to seeing comedies now go to whatever extremes they need to try and elicit laughs, elicit shock, elicit those. So the absurdity in this is really, I felt, was used as a vehicle to show that the two of them had an attraction still. Because you got to believe that in this film with all what's going on in the story arc in order to feel like this story works. Because at the end, there is, not to jump to the end, but there's these two getting back together. And you have to believe along the way with all the shenanigans that are going on that these two actually love, not just like each other, they love each other enough that is the conclusion that should be happening here. The shaving part, I think, was a way to show, yeah, she's talking about maybe marrying Jeff, but that's not where her heart is. And I liked that those pieces were happening in this. It's such an intriguing film because these two are brats, whereas we're very used to like the laughs and ha-ha-has and the roll on the floors are kind of what take you through a comedy, per se. And in this case, they're two people that like almost – it's. I don't know if I want them together because I love them together or I think they deserve each other. I think that was an interesting part of this film. It's a very intriguing watch. I think casting is critical of this. We referenced Carol Lombard earlier, and I think she was perfect in her role. Casting in this is really, I think, when you do a screwball comedy like this, there has to be an element of likability to the main characters that I do think this film maintained all the way through. Because if you don't like those two and you don't like on some level want to see them together, this film doesn't work. And it's strange to keep seeing with everything that happened in this that you wanted to see them together versus being friends that want to intervene and say you two shouldn't be together. But I did feel at the end that like I did want them together. I didn't want them with anybody else. And that was an intriguing sort of piece with this journey.
Well, when you talk about that, I guess, you know, we could talk about the casting. And Carol Lombard, no question in my mind, is perfect in this role. She fits it, and you know, she gave what I believe is support for the thought that she is the queen of the screwball comedy, because again, I thought she fit it perfectly. The bigger question is Robert Montgomery, who I know more as Elizabeth's dad than an actor. I haven't seen him in a lot of things. He struck me as very white bread. Like, the same part could have been played by almost anybody. At one point, apparently, they did consider Cary Grant for the role. I think he would have been superior in it. I also saw that this has been done as, like, a radio play at some point, and that Errol Flynn did the part in that. And I could picture it in my mind with him playing the part, and I think it would have been great.
Yeah, that radio play, unfortunately, doesn't exist anymore. The two radio adaptations that still exist, the one that came out in 1941 stars Bob Hope, and that was on Lux Radio Theater. And then there was another one on the Screen Directors Playhouse with Robert Montgomery in the role. They actually ran both of them on my old-time radio, because this whole series inspired me to do all the Hitchcock adaptations I could find. So I do think I found the Robert Montgomery one more entertaining than the Bob Hope one, but I think it's because, like we're saying, that there's very little overt comedy, and Bob Hope can deliver a funny line. I find he's not a great actor. So unless you have set up punchline, I don't find Bob Hope satisfying. And this is not a set up punchline kind of comedy.
I like Bob Hope in things I've seen him in, but I can picture exactly what you're saying, that if you don't give him the right material, he doesn't rise above it. Whereas I'm going with Cary Grant and Errol Flynn, who I think do rise above the material.
Well, Cary Grant, especially like in this period, was the king of screwball comedies, and it's kind of a shame we never got Cary Grant and Carol Lombard together. That would have been a film.
Yeah, I agree. I think that would have been better. Then the third part in this is Gene Raymond. Now, I heard something recently, and I find it interesting because he actually did do something with one of the radio shows. But in the screwball comedy, there is the third part of the love triangle, the one who you don't want to get together with the romantic lead. And Ralph Bellamy apparently played that part in so many romantic comedies, so many screwball comedies, that they called that character the Bellamy. That name was adapted to him. And Gene Raymond plays it in this. I thought he did a good job, because I thought he seemed fairly genuine, but you never wanted him to be the one who won out. And I think that's exactly his role.
Yeah, it's unlike a lot of the third wheels in the modern romantic comedies. They didn't make anyone explicitly unlikable. I find, especially the 80s and 90s, I have a really hard time with a lot of romantic comedies, because they effectively start with infidelity, and they get the audience on board with that by making the other person completely unlikable right out of the gate. So you say, oh, I don't want him to be with her, or I don't want her to be with him. Whereas here, the third party, he seems viable. Like, he's not a bad guy. There's nothing wrong with him. It's just with things like the shaving and the ski trip, they make it clear that Montgomery and Lombard are a better fit for each other than he would be.
I'm going to invoke the bro code clause
here. I was just going to do that.
He clearly knew. Where David Smith fell on things, you know. I know from a societal perspective, he was a more upstanding citizen, but there were some friendship and relationship codes he was breaking left and right in this film.
There were, but this film was made maybe two or three decades after the point where a widow's business partner could take everything the widow owned, on the grounds that, or that, you know, if a man's business partner could, okay, man has a business partner, one man dies and he's married, the other business partner could have taken everything that was left to the widow, on the grounds that I helped build that business. So the rapid remarriage to preserve ownership was common. So yeah, I see. In the 2020s, this wouldn't fly. The only way to make this work is if he had a private conversation with David at the end, saying, okay, so our plan worked, right? We showed her the other side and helped her realize that you are who she wants. If you find out that none of his intentions were genuine and he was just giving her that sample to drive her back to David, that could pull it off today. in the 1940s, I don't think that was necessary because of what crap women had to put up with.
I kind of fall in the middle of both of you on this one, because I think one of the things that worked on this piece is Jeff is likable. I agree with that thought process. And when they're like, when the two of them are dating, like, I enjoy seeing them together, because I think it's important, because we've got to be able to see David left out of everything and starting to feel sympathetic to David, because David does his reveal of, hey, I wouldn't have married you if, like, I had to do it over again. And then until now, he has to be faced with that and really regret it and want her back, or the you know, to win the quest. The area where I think Jeff is completely and utterly wrong, David, I'll help you. Let me get you two together and talking and all that kind of thing, nudge, nudge, and all that type of thing. Not more than 2 seconds after that meeting doesn't go well, while David is standing right there, hey, you want to go out? That's where he broke. That's where I think he 1,000% broke guy code. And, you know, like, the corpse was, like, still, like, breathing. So, but I think it worked for this film. Like, pacing, I think, is really critical to this whole piece. Because you have to believe, to a certain extent, even though Jeff is really likable, which I agree with you, Blaine, you have to also have that part of yourself where it's like, yeah, but he's a dog. I mean, and it's an interesting line you skirt with this character. And I think I actually think it's where the writing is really strong, is the fact that you don't dislike, like, blatantly flat out really dislike Jeff. When he interacts with David, you can see why the two of them are still friends, but David's also going in there and poking him at time to time in the office. You know, when the in-laws, if we want to call them that,
yeah,
are in the other room, David, you know, when Jeff's family is in the other room, David goes over and he's making a spectacle of himself and all of that, while being the beloved buddy, according to the parents, and them kind of figuring out, wait, what is going on here? He knows way too much about her. Who is this girl? I actually, all of that vehicle worked, but at the same time, I did find, like, I wasn't rooting for her to wind up with Jeff, which I think if you make him too likable, like, if you don't have that little edge, you're going to want her to – I actually think you're going to want her to wind up with Jeff, just because Jeff's more together out of the two of them. David's got problems.
Yeah, but
like she does.
I thought Jeff was presented as very, very white bread and kind of boring. Mm-hmm. And I think that's mm-hmm. the thing that makes you want to have her with David, because yeah. David is at yeah. least interesting.
Yeah, Jeff is bland but not off-putting.
Yeah, there's nothing nothing that makes you dislike him, but he's just not fun. He's, you know, he's like, oh, you know, I mean, his first thing is, oh, you got to meet my parents. You know, that's not really what you know, what romances are made of.
Yeah, Jeff he's the kind of character that can make a lot of women happy, just not this one. Not in the long term. She is a better fit with David, and they make that clear, which is, like we said, it's absolutely critical that the couple that's together at the end is the couple that you want to see together at the end.
Oh, absolutely. Otherwise, retroactively, it kills the whole movie.
Yeah.
Their relationship is driven by the need for each other's attention. Like, it's right from the beginning of the film, straight on through. Everything they're doing is, look at me, pay attention to me. And even their 3-day to 8-day sabbatical in the beginning, you know, he's peeking over couches, those type of things. And she's peeking out of the covers, which how it progresses all the way through. They're trying to get each other's attention and wanting that and needing that intense attention from the other one. All of their arguments and bickering and quote unquote bratty behavior is really driven towards that essential goal. And it's, you've got to have that in the film, because what worked for me with this is I felt like they were a couple. I wanted to see them together. I felt there was love there between the two of them. It's crazy love, but I felt that that was a thing.
What I liked in the film is, Paul, I can understand why you became an attorney in practice where you do, because evidently you only have to show up like 3 days every 4 months.
You know what? No one ever told me that. But I mean, that I think that's a common, if you want to call it a flaw, a common flaw in a lot of these movies where, you know, the career they have is used to the extent that it could somehow either give a slight bit of background or that it could drive the plot, but they're not going to ever try to make it realistic. You see that in all sorts of even current day stuff where, you know, these people either have homes, apartments, whatever, that are way beyond the means of the career that they would have, or that they have a job that, like you say, they go in 2 or 3 days a month and that's it because they have so much free time. I think that's a common flaw, and it almost requires that you just kind of say, yeah, whatever.
The staff does think they're nuts, though. Like, that's throughout the film, like, the reaction of others watching all of this unfolding, they do reflect, I mean, even their staff at their home think they're crazy. But at the office, like, even the client, there's David interacting with the one client who is, like, questioning, like, are you even doing anything for me? And I think those pieces added to what we're saying here that, like, okay, yeah, he's going in 2 or 3 days a week, and there is a reaction to that. Like, no, people just, they aren't as okay with it as, I mean, they're more okay with it than would be, because if people were completely oblivious to that, I don't know that this film would have worked for me in a lot of the ways that it did.
Maybe that was Jeff's secret plan. Maybe David actually started coming into the office more frequently.
I didn't think any of the other casting choices were critical in this. Like, the people who play the parents, you could pretty much get people off the street to cover those roles. I didn't think there was anything significant about anybody else in the movie. And I think that is just a reflection of the fact that it really is carried by the three leads. That's the only critical roles in the movie.
I do have one. Gertie. I do think you need to cast Gertie the right way. And I do think, actually, that's the one area where I will say maybe this is a little Hitchcockian, because I don't think David saying, Gertie, we're not working, would have gotten rid of Gertie. So what happened to Gertie? I think there's a whole movie here, as far as, because that woman was not going, that woman was taking control, that woman was taking charge, and she was not going anywhere. But with David. So we don't know what happened to her. And I think there is a subplot here where we could have a Hitchcock movie on our hands. But that casting was, I thought that was one where you needed the right girl, where she had to be like the right amount of, like, David does not want to be sitting by her in order for that whole sequence to work. But yet you see, like, an environment where he's still trying to make her jealous. I thought that was a funny sequence. The double date and him kind of watching that. I thought that was a well done sequence. And I thought some of the casting there was important. The buddy, it didn't matter who that guy was, but I felt like the girl he was sitting by was more important, actually, than the pretty girl that was next to him, because that could have been anybody, because he just needed her as a prop, whereas you needed to really believe he did not want to be sitting with the girl he was actually with.
Well, that's part of the class divide that pops up in these a lot. I mean, whatever Jack Carson's character did for a living, he was making enough that he could afford, you know, to be a member of the same club. But you get a feeling that there's a slight class divide between Jeff and David, and then a much larger divide between David and the Jack Carson character.
I personally didn't see a lot of other themes and issues that were significant in the movie. So I'm going to hand it off to you guys if there's anything else that you saw before we move on to other topics. Okay, I'm going to take that as no, you guys agree with me.
Yeah, I saw nothing, and based on the Truffaut interview, I don't know that Hitchcock did either. So we know that he pursued it to try and expand his horizons. Carol Lombard asked him. She did actually make that request. But when he was going through it with Truffaut, the only story he tells about it is that he'd already made that famous comment about actors being like cattle. And he said that was in the context of the British actors who considered film work like slumming it. So they would come in and shoot quickly and then go between their matinee and evening performances on the Broadway stage. So that's where the comment came from. But apparently Carol Lombard had heard it. So when he showed up for the first day of filming, Lombard had had the studio build a corral. And inside there were three cows with nameplates of Carol Lombard, Robert Montgomery, and... Right, just as that joke. But aside from that, the only other thing that he had to say about this with Truffaut is he didn't really understand characters like this. So he just shot the script as written and moved on and ultimately considered it a waste of time.
The only spot where I felt what we would come to expect as Hitchcock's artistry was on display was in the World's Fair scene as they ascended on the ride. There you had some of the visual dynamism you kind of expect from a Hitchcock film, but that was really the only sequence where I was like, okay, that's Hitchcock.
I thought there were some framing choices that seemed to be, like, I could easily see them translating to one of his suspense films. And it's not that I thought they were inappropriate. It's just that they seemed to fit with the Hitchcockian look to me. And that could be me pushing a round peg into a square hole, or that could be reality. I'm not sure. You know, it might be just that I knew it was Hitchcock, so I was looking for it and saw it. The score in the movie, I thought, was adequate. It seemed almost a little too bouncy for me at times. The score almost cried out to me, "Hey, look how funny we are," which I don't know that it delivered what it was, the message it was sending. That's more or less what I didn't think it was a bad. I didn't think it was bad music. I just didn't think it was always fit what was on the screen totally.
Yeah, I would agree. It felt like the score at times was trying hard to compensate, as though the composer knew, this is not a bringing up baby, so let me try to convince the audience it is with music. And try to push it a little more in that direction than it naturally was going.
Now, if I didn't know where Alfred appeared in the movie, because we could do Where's Alfred now, if I didn't know, I don't think I would have seen him. Unfortunately, I had seen something before I watched it that said where he was. Did any of you watch it without knowing in advance and spot him?
I knew where it was. That was how I knew.
Yeah, this time I knew. I don't recall if I knew before or after when I saw this the first time, because I knew that was a thing with him. So the first time I watch it, if I don't catch him, I go look up where and then go back and see it. So when I first saw this 20 years ago, I don't know if that was how I saw it or not, but yeah, this time I knew exactly where to look.
I saw an interesting little tidbit about that. It was on IMDb that Carol Lombard actually directed him in his cameo and made him do repeated times.
Yes.
Which I thought was kind of intriguing, just because, you know, usually we're so focused on where is he. I thought this was intriguing that he was actually directed by her, and she made him do repeated takes, which that had been intriguing.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Hey, that wasn't very good. Let's do this other one.
I also heard that, you know, not that I heard it, excuse me. I also was intrigued by the fact that Hitchcock was such a control freak that the fact that he let her direct that sequence, I think, spoke to their personal relationship. Because I don't think he would have let the average actor or actress do that.
No, but I also think he could have gotten away with it by doing one take the way he wanted it and just using that take no matter what she said and made him do.
I did see a review where they talked about it a little bit, and they said that she actually did something that, you know, that he didn't tell her to do. She did it on her own, where she kind of pulls out during the scene and lets it expand as it goes on, and that they felt that actually looked Hitchcockian. So that's an interesting take on it. But if anybody is interested, that scene takes place at 42 minutes and 58 seconds into the movie, and Montgomery's walking out of the building with Jeff, and Hitchcock just kind of walks by the front of the building smoking a cigar. I'm always disappointed now if he isn't carrying some type of musical instrument. So, anything else on this one? I mean, I think we were a little brief on it, but I think this wasn't heavy material. Anything else on it that you think needs to be discussed before we rate it?
Nope.
All right. I thought this was light fare. I thought it was entertaining to watch, but I don't feel like I need to see it again. I don't think, again, I never got any really heavy laughs out of it. But it was, you know, it wasn't like, oh my God, I need that hour and a half of my life back again. It wasn't bad. It just wasn't stellar. I think, you know, if I wanted to watch a screwball comedy again at this point, there are many other choices that I think would be above this. So I'm going to give this one a Psycho 3. It's not that it was a bad movie, but it just wasn't anything special.
Yeah, I'm exactly where you're at, Paul. I wouldn't want our listeners to think that we're saying, whatever you do, don't watch this movie, because we're not. But it was telling, as I was trying to kind of process my thoughts, I kept saying, it's not this film. You know, it's not Bringing Up Baby. It's not, you know, His Girl Friday. It's not My Favorite White. And that's telling. I wouldn't rush to turn it off, but I don't think this would stop me from flipping channels if it was on.
Yeah, I think if I was watching TCM and this came on and I didn't have anything else to do, I'd probably leave it. But if there was something else more compelling, I would switch.
Yeah, I think this helps solidify that reputation that Paul mentioned earlier, Master of Suspense. Hitchcock works in multiple genres. And as I understand it, and I think as we'll see as this series shapes up over the months and years to come, he's known as the Master of Suspense because that's the genre where he excels. The rest, he is kind of pedestrian. He'll get the job done, but it's more utilitarian than innovation. So I'm also falling in the Psycho 3. This is, you know, because to my mind, Psycho 1 is where you plan multiple repeat viewings. Psycho 2 is once in a while you're going to say, I feel like watching that again. And, you know, Psycho 3 is, well, I don't regret watching it, but, you know, you will probably stumble on something else, especially since, you know, I don't have cable anymore. So I don't do the channel flipping. Channel flipping, I might watch it again if I came across it. Now I'm selecting something to watch, and I don't see myself going back to this unless I decide to do a full Hitchcock chronological rewatch at any point. And then Psycho 4 is just, once is definitely enough.
Unless all of a sudden you find yourself with several hundred free hours.
Yeah. Well, we're at... so far, we have spent 17 hours, 47 minutes watching Hitchcock. If we watch each of these movies, we covered once each. By the time we have done this and mixed in with the other bonus we want to do, it's going to be 129 hours and 3 minutes.
It's amazing that you've figured that out. And it just shows how you fit into this group of OCD kind of people. Sean, where do you have this one ranked?
I kind of struggled with this one, where to put it, because my wife and I watched it together and we found it really enjoyable. But that word, I think, is critical for me. This is one of those where I usually rate my Psycho 2s as the rewatchability factor is kind of key there, and my urgency to rewatch it. I would rewatch this. So for anybody listening to this, I do think if you're interested in kind of exploring Hitchcock, it's an enjoyable movie. So this isn't going to be something where you're going to, it's not a painful watch or anything like that. There's a good time to be had here. But I think that's the key on this one. And I think I was struggling with them. Is this a really low Jaws or Psycho 2? Or is this a really high Psycho 3? I'm going to say really high Psycho 3 because I don't want to like put it in that category of where avoid this. And I think that's been put out there by really everyone here. I think this is something that's worth seeing. I don't think it's one of those where it's essential Hitchcock viewing. It's one of those where if you're a fan and you kind of want to see more of what Hitchcock's doing, this isn't going to be one that's going to make you angry afterwards either. Like that. And I like the characters, even the ending, which we didn't mention. I liked the whole bit with the skis, where her ski was already off. She could have escaped. And she was kind of getting that ski back on so that way she could still be trapped with him at the end. Stuff like that I found charming. I found them charming. And if it was on again, I would watch it again. So it's not one of those where I would avoid it. It's a movie that I had fun with. But I say high Jaws 3 or high Psycho 4.
I'm going to throw in one little comment on that because you said you wouldn't see it as essential Hitchcock viewing, which I totally get, except if you're truly doing a study of Hitchcock.
Yes.
I think to see him and see how he adjusted to a different genre might be interesting for that study. So if you were doing truly a Hitchcock study, I do think this would probably be essential viewing.
I would say that, yes, it's important to watch a Hitchcock comedy. Mm-hmm. If you said, I'm going to watch a Hitchcock comedy, what do you recommend? It wouldn't be this one. It would be one that we haven't covered yet.
Mm. But those would be dark comedies as opposed to screwball comedy. So I think you could still say it's a different genre.
You could, yes. But I think that's what it is. If you're just looking for sheer entertainment, you need to come in knowing this is not suspense. Like I said, it's the first time I watched it, I might have ranked it as Jaws 4 because I was over halfway through before I realized, okay, there is going to be no suspense element. It's not a slow start. That's just not this movie. So I wasn't properly engaged the first time through because I didn't know he had broken genre from his reputation. This time was a much more positive experience. But again, I said Psycho 3, but with the same thought process Sean did. So it doesn't quite cross that Psycho 2 line. But it... Yeah, if you were to say to me, give me your top 20 Hitchcock films, this wouldn't make the cut.
No, I agree.
But if you want to say study Hitchcock as a filmmaker, then yes, you have to see a variety of the genres he's played with, and then it shows up on that list.
Totally.
But if someone just says, what makes Hitchcock Hitchcock? Why is he the master of suspense? This is not on that short list at all.
Well, this could show you why he was pigeonholed as a master of suspense and not the master of comedy. You know, there are filmmakers out there who have done numerous genres and succeeded in numerous genres to a great extent. And I'm not saying he failed in this one. He didn't. But it isn't a movie that's going on, you know, AFI isn't looking to put this on their, you know, top 100 list, and they're not looking to save this for posterity. It's just, you know, it's a well-made screwball comedy, but it's not, you know, anything that really stands out. So, you know, perhaps this is just not Hitchcock's genre. And I think that is borne out a little bit by the fact that he was dismissive of it. He just kind of went through the motions and made the movie, but didn't sit there and feel like this was something apparently to be proud of or something, you know, that was particularly a challenge for him in any way.
I feel like we're talking about one of the world's greatest baseball players who can't play basketball at the same level that he plays baseball.
That's fair.
It's not a bad film. Hitchcock didn't do a bad job directing it, but while Preston Sturges can't direct a suspense thriller like Hitchcock can, Hitchcock can't direct a screwball comedy like Preston Sturges can. It's just different strengths and aptitudes.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I don't mean to be overly critical of this movie. And again, it was enjoyable fare to watch, you know, while it was on. It just was not, it didn't excel. I guess that's the biggest criticism I have of it, is it didn't excel. And I've come to a point where I expect Hitchcock movies to be at a certain level. You know, I expect the floor for a Hitchcock movie to be at a certain level. And when anytime we go below that level, I'm disappointed.
Yeah, like I think what's coming down is this is just utilitarian, below average for its genre. But some of that disappointment we're experiencing is because it has the Hitchcock name on it.
I think you might
if
even
this
say
had
average.
The name of a director we did not recognize, right? If we did not know the name of the director attached to this film, if it was a new name in the credits, I would say, okay, it got the job done. Probably early in their career, I would be open to seeing what they learned from this experience and what their next movie turned out like. But yeah,
I would say for the genre, this was probably average, because I think we're comparing it to movies that are above average. When we talk about Bringing a Baby, that's almost like the prototypical screwball comedy. You know, we're not saying, oh, let's just compare it to a screwball comedy. We're saying let's compare it to the most famous screwball comedy. So, I don't know that that's really a fair comparison.
That's true. When I said below average, I was probably comparing it to the screwball comedies I've seen, and the ones I bothered to see 80 or 90 years down the road are the best that have been cherry picked.
Exactly. I think we're all in agreement on it. It's just a matter of how we're describing it. But next time around, I can tell you when we all get together, we're not going to do a screwball comedy, but I don't know which movie we're going to do. So, Blaine?
Oh, looking at our list where we're going through, you know, ranked by popularity, split it in the middle. So we just, Mr. and Mrs. Smith was high in the low half of popularity. Next up is not. The next one is, I would say, a Hitchcock top five. We're going to be looking at Rear Window.
Oh, that's going to be fun. So everybody, watch that and be ready to listen to us, because I think we're going to have a good time going through that one. So thanks, guys, for coming on. Thank you, everybody, for listening. In the meanwhile, just, you know, be careful in the shower, because there's psychos out there. Bye-bye.
You know it was all my fault.
No, Andy, it was mine.
My fault, dear.
Mm-mm. My darling. I shouldn't be jealous so much, and I should lay off your family.
A wife should conduct herself to please her husband. That's one of the rules I'm going to make.
Another one?
Mm-hmm. What's the day today?
Darling, I think I better be running along.
Oh, no, honey, not just yet. Remember rule number 7.
Yes, but I thought we'd given that one up. It always got us into so much trouble.
Well, if we ever give up one, that means we're giving up just that much of our wonderful relationship. If we're letting down, you wouldn't want me to feel that, would you?
But those questions you ask each month, like about that trip I took to Paris the year I graduated from college. I was only 21.
Well, I forgave you that.
Shoot.
If you had it all to do over again, would you have married me?
Honestly, no. Not that I'd want to be married to anyone else, but I think that when a man marries, he gives up a certain amount of freedom and independence. If I had to do it all over again, I think I would stay single. He wanted me to answer you truthfully because we respect each other. We're honest with each other. Your feelings aren't hurt, are they?
Oh, no, it's perfectly all right.
It's enough of that. I was getting into trouble.
I'm not angry in the least.
Oh, yes, you are. You don't understand. I was only answering a hypothetical question of what I would do if I had to do it all over again.
David, if you want your freedom, I don't want to be the kind of a wife who clings to her husband when she's not wanted.
Darling, I do want to be married to you. I love you. I worship you. I am used to you. How do we always get into these things?
Well, if my only hold on you is that you're used to me.
You've got the whole thing wrong. I don't know what I'd do without you. You are my little girl. Now, don't cry. Don't cry. Forgive me? Say you forgive me. Now, can I go to work?